You are listening to a recording made available by the Friends of Israel Gospel Ministry Incorporated as a service to God's people. This is message number 9 of 12 on the Book of Daniel by Dr. Reynold Showers. This message is entitled, God's Sovereign Chastening of Israel in the Near Future.
In chapters 2 through 7 of the Book of Daniel, God is demonstrating His sovereign rule over the affairs of Gentiles on planet Earth. In Daniel chapter 7, God revealed the whole future course of Gentile world dominion to His prophet Daniel. And as a result of that revelation that came to Daniel, we find Daniel's reaction to what God had presented to him in verse 28 of Daniel chapter 7. Daniel says, at this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. Daniel was very disturbed as a result of this revelation that God had given to him. I'm convinced that what disturbed him was a nagging question. Lord, if there are going to be 3 more great Gentile kingdoms after the present Babylonian kingdom, obviously the Gentiles are going to be in dominion over the earth for an extended period of time. What will happen to my people Israel during all of this time? Does this mean that Israel is headed for extended troublesome times? Right now we are under the heel of the Gentile Babylonians. Will Israel continue to be under the heel of Gentiles during that second and third and fourth Gentile world power? And Daniel was so disturbed over what this could signify concerning the people of Israel that he didn't even share this revelation with his fellow Jews who were held captive with him in the land of Babylon. And he's wondering, what about Israel for the future? And so, in response to this nagging question that it was eating away at God's servant, God decided now to shift his emphasis away from that of his sovereign rule over the Gentiles and to begin revealing to his prophet Daniel what his future program was for the nation of Israel. And so chapter 7 ends for us revelation concerning the great Gentile nations and God's dealing with those nations. And now, beginning with chapter 8 and going through chapter 12, we have God demonstrating His sovereign rule over the nation of Israel. Again, chapters 8 through 12. And when we come specifically to chapter 8, this is what we have contained: God's chastening of Israel in the near future. God's chastening of Israel in the near future. And before we begin our individual study of chapter 8, I should point out something else about this new section that is just beginning. We saw the other day that most of chapters 2 through 7 were written in the Aramaic language rather than the Hebrew language. The reason for that being that the Aramaic language in Daniel's day was the universal language. It was the business, the political language of the day. All the Jews as well as all the Gentiles knew the Aramaic language. And so since chapters 2 through 7 were dealing with God's program for the Gentiles, and the Gentiles could not understand the Hebrew language, at least most of them would not have understood it, God purposely had that section written in the Aramaic language so the Gentiles could read what God, the God of Israel, was going to do with them. But now that we come to chapters 8 through 12, where God is going to unfold His whole future program for the nation of Israel, Daniel shifts back once again to the Hebrew language that primarily only the Jews would understand, because this section was dealing with God's program for them. Wasn't that essential at that time that the Gentiles know how God was going to deal with a special, unique Old Testament people? In chapter 8, God gives another dream or vision to Daniel. And I'm going to approach this chapter in a little different fashion than we have the other ones because of the way that it is laid out and the way that God presents this particular revelation to Daniel. Let me give to you first the threefold outline of this chapter, and then we're going to jump right into the middle of the chapter to see some things that will help us understand the rest of the chapter, and then tie the beginning part and the end part together. The first section of Daniel chapter 8, which is contained in verse 1, we could entitle Daniel's Second Vision Introduced. Daniel's Second Vision Introduced, chapter 8, verse 1. The second section of chapter 8 is contained in verses 2 through 14. And this we could entitle The Content of the Vision, verses 2 through 14. And here Daniel spells out for us exactly what God portrayed for him in this second vision. And then the third and final section of chapter 8, which is contained in verses 15 through 27, we could entitle The Interpretation of the Vision. And here, an angel of God interprets the second vision for God's prophet Daniel. Now let's look very briefly at the first section, Daniel's second vision introduced, chapter 8, verse 1. Daniel tells us, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which had appeared to me previously. He's making it very clear that this vision came to him later than the vision he had just recorded in Daniel chapter 7. He tells us that he received this vision from God in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar of Babylon. That would be the year 545 B.C. Daniel, there in the land of Babylon, while the Babylonian rulers are still in control, before Medo-Persia conquered the Babylonian Empire, received the second great vision from God, 545 B.C. Now, if we are to understand properly the content and interpretation of this vision, we must jump immediately to verses 15 through 19. Daniel says, "It came about when I, Daniel, had seen the vision that I sought to understand it." Again, he was curious. "Lord, what does this vision mean that you have just revealed to me? And behold, standing before me was one who looked like a man. And I heard the voice of a man between the banks of Uli, and he called out and said, 'Gabriel, give this man an understanding of the vision.'" Daniel sees two characters here, one that he says looks like a man, and the other one is the angel Gabriel. Whoever this first figure is that looks like a man, he is authoritative over angels because he commands the great angel Gabriel to come and minister to Daniel. Many are convinced that this unique person that Daniel saw is the pre-incarnate Christ, who is appearing there temporarily in the form of a human being, and who the scriptures tell us is an authority over angels. But he commands the angel Gabriel to minister to Daniel and to give Daniel understanding of this particular vision. In other words, the angel Gabriel has the responsibility of interpreting the vision for Daniel. Verse 17, Daniel says of Gabriel, "So he came near to where I was standing, and when he came, I was frightened and fell on my face. But he said to me, 'Son of man, understand that the vision pertains to the time of the end.' Now while he was talking with me, I sank into a deep sleep with my face to the ground, but he touched me and made me stand upright, and he said, 'Behold, I'm going to let you know what will occur at the final period of the indignation, for it pertains to the appointed time of the end.'" Now let me zero in for a while on that expression, "the indignation," that is contained in verse 19. Because Gabriel says to Daniel, this particular vision deals with the final period of the indignation. The word indignation, as it stands by itself, simply means wrath or displeasure. But notice, there's the definite article "the" with the word indignation. The indignation. The word "the indignation" is referring to a specific period of time in which God pours out his chastening wrath, or in which God is indignant or disturbed with his people of Israel because they are in rebellion against him. This actually is a technical term in the Bible, the indignation, again referring to a very definite period of history. When Israel is out of joint spiritually with God in rebellion against him, and God is indignant with that nation and is displaying his displeasure against the people of Israel by chastening them because they are in rebellion against him spiritually. Now, we've already noted in Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7, where God was portraying his dealings with Gentile world empires during the course of world history, that God has a specific program for the Gentiles. We noted in Luke 21, verse 24, the other day, that Jesus referred to God's program for the Gentiles as the times of the Gentiles. The times of the Gentiles began when the Babylonians conquered the people of Israel back in the late 600s B.C. And we've seen that the times of the Gentiles extends from the Babylonian captivity of the Jews right up to the second coming of the Lord Jesus back to planet Earth. But a question could be asked, if that is God's program for the Gentiles for that span of history, what is God's program for the people of Israel during that same span of history? Here it is. God's program for Israel, while the times of the Gentiles is going on, is called in the Bible the indignation. So that God has two programs running parallel with each other during the same span of history. One program for the Gentiles that Jesus called the times of the Gentiles, and another program for the Jews that the scriptures call the indignation. While God is allowing the Gentiles to dominate and rule the world, he is at that same time displeased with the nation of Israel and chastening the nation of Israel because it is out of joint spiritually with him. So the indignation of Israel also began with the Babylonian captivity of the Jews around 605 B.C. and continues right up until the second coming of the Lord Jesus. But notice, if you would, verse 19, Gabriel says to Daniel that this particular vision deals with the final period of the indignation. This could also be translated that it deals with the latter time of the indignation. Now that expression, the latter time or final period of the indignation, would seem to imply that this whole program of God called the indignation for Israel has two divisions to it. The first part of the indignation could be called the former time of indignation. And the second part, Gabriel calls here, the final period, or the latter time of the indignation. In Daniel's day, when he received this vision, the Babylonian captivity of the Jews was almost at its end. This would seem to indicate then that the former time of the indignation was the Babylonian captivity of Israel. But the latter time of the indignation that this vision is dealing with here in chapter 8 begins with the end of the Babylonian captivity of the Jews, 536 B.C., and extends right up to the second coming. Gabriel is saying to Daniel, this particular vision that you have just now received deals with the latter time, the final period of the indignation, from the time when the Babylonian captivity of the Jews ends, right up until the second coming of the Lord Jesus. And we're going to see more specifically, this particular vision is dealing with the time that the Medo-Persians and the Greeks would be dominating the people of Israel. And God would be using those two great Gentile kingdoms of Medo-Persia and Greece as his tools to chasten his Old Testament people because of their spiritual rebellion against God. So this, in essence, is what this particular vision in chapter 8 is dealing with. Now, let's begin to look both at the content and interpretation of this vision. And I would point out to you that verses 2 through 4 and verse 20 go together. Verses 2 through 4 gives us the first part of the content of this vision, and verse 20 gives us the interpretation of that first part of the vision. Look, please, at verses 2 through 4. Daniel says, "And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was in the citadel, the fortress of Susa, which is in the province of Elam. And I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal." After Medo-Persia had conquered Babylon, Medo-Persia made the city of Susa, or Shushan, its major capital city. Shushan was located between two rivers that came together at a point around both sides of that great city. In order to protect that key capital city, the Medo-Persians built a large fortress right in the point where the two rivers came together. The fortress was basically in the shape of a triangle. This meant that along one side of the fortress there was a river, along the other side of that triangle fortress there was another river. But in order to completely surround the fortress with water and give it greater protection, the Medo-Persians dug a canal along the third side of that triangle fortress, a canal that was approximately 900 feet in length that joined together the two rivers. That particular canal they called the Ulai Canal. And that's the canal that Daniel refers to here. Now notice, in the vision, God is projecting him into the future, and he sees himself standing in that Medo-Persian fort that was right there where the two rivers came together and had the Ulai Canal running along the other side. But he goes on to tell us in verse 3, "Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram, which had two horns, was standing in front of the canal. Now the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue from his power. But he did as he pleased and magnified himself." Daniel says, "As I was observing my vision and saw myself being portrayed standing in this fortress near the Ulai Canal, I noted a ram standing there right in front of that canal." Evidently the ram there to protect the fortress, which in turn protected the capital city of Shushan. And this ram had two long horns coming out of its head. One of those horns eventually became longer than the other. Now what does this ram represent? Remember, this is a vision, so the ram is symbolic of something that was real. Well, thankfully, the angel Gabriel in verse 20 interprets this ram for Daniel. He says, verse 20, "The ram which you saw with the two horns represents the kings of Media and Persia." We've already seen that in the Orient, in ancient times, kings and kingdoms were synonymous with each other. And so, therefore, Gabriel is saying this ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire, the one that would conquer Babylon, just a few years after Daniel received this particular vision. But this ram had two horns upon its head. We noted the other day that the Medo-Persian Empire was a partnership empire, where two distinct national peoples, the Medes and the Persians, had been united together under one king in the year 550 B.C. The two horns on the head of this ram represent those two partners, one horn representing the Medes, the other horn representing the Persians. But notice, one of these horns becomes larger in size than the other. We've already noted it's a fact of history that as the Medo-Persian Empire continued its existence on the face of the earth, through time, one of those two partners, namely the Persians, gained the ascendancy over the other partner, the Medes. And this is what God is foretelling ahead of time here by portraying the one horn representing the Persians becoming higher or longer than the other horn, which represents the Medes. This ram in Daniel chapter 8 corresponds with the bear of Daniel chapter 7, which, remember, had one side higher than the other side, again representing the Persians gaining the ascendancy over the Medes. And it also corresponds with the two arms and breast of silver of the image in Daniel chapter 2, the two arms representing the two partners, coming together to form one breast, signifying the Medes and the Persians being united together to form this partnership empire. Verses 5 through 8 go together with verses 21 and 22 of Daniel chapter 8. Look, if you would, please, at verse 5. While I was observing, particularly this ram, which had conquered in three directions, the west, the north, and the south, by the way, that's accurate too, Medo-Persia never carried on conquest east in an eastward direction, and the reason is because Medo-Persia was located in the east. But it did conquer north of itself, west of itself, and south of itself. And Daniel says, while I was observing this ram conquering in the three directions, no one else able to withstand its conquering power, behold a second animal that appeared in my vision. A male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. The idea is this male goat was running so rapidly that it looked as if its feet were not even touching the ground. Tremendous speed being emphasized here for this male goat. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes, a great horn coming up out of its head between its eyes. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him, the goat, come beside the ram, and he, the goat, was enraged at the ram. And he struck the ram and shattered his two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground and trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from his power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. Now, thankfully, again, the angel Gabriel, in verses 21 and 22, interpreted this part of the vision for Daniel. Notice, please, Gabriel said, and the shaggy goat represents the kingdom of Greece, and the large horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, the first great king of the Grecian Empire that eventually conquered the Medo-Persian Empire was Alexander the Great. And so this conspicuous horn coming out of the head between the eyes of this male goat is representing the first great king of the Grecian Empire, Alexander the Great. And he goes on to say, verse 22, and the broken horn and the four horns that arose in its place represent four kingdoms which will arise from his nation, although not with his power. In the vision, the he-goat comes running very rapidly from the western part of the world and crashes with tremendous force into the ram, representing the fact that Greece, under the leadership of Alexander the Great, would attack the Medo-Persian Empire represented by the ram and would completely crush the Medo-Persian Empire. Notice we're told in verses 5 through 8 that when the goat flies into the ram, it breaks. The two horns are on the ram's head. This is an indicator that Alexander the Great and his Greek Macedonian army would conquer both partners of the Medo-Persian Empire, both the Medes and the Persians, and just does away with Medo-Persian rule altogether. And that's exactly what happened. Keep in mind, again, this was prophecy. God is spelling this out years before it happened. But beginning in 334 B.C., and ending by 331 B.C., Alexander the Great and his Greek Macedonian army had completely decimated the Medo-Persian Empire and assimilated it now into this new Grecian Gentile Empire. But the vision goes on to say that no sooner did the male goat come to the peak of its power than the one great horn that came out of its head broke And there were four new horns that rose up out of the head of the male goat to replace the one great horn. We've already been told that the one great horn was the first great king of the Grecian Empire, Alexander the Great. And it is a fact of history that no sooner had Alexander the Great extended his Grecian kingdom to its uttermost extremes of boundaries than Alexander the Great himself was cut off with death in the year 323 B.C., when only 32 years of age. There is the great horn out of the male goat's head being broken. It is also a fact of history that after Alexander the Great died, the four leading generals of his Grecian army subdivided the Greek Empire among themselves into four divisions. And this is what God is representing ahead of time with the four horns that come up out of the head of the male goat to take over where the one great horn had been before. The Grecian Empire subdivided among Alexander the Great's four leading generals. But notice, verse 22, we are told that neither one of those four sub-kingdoms or kings of the Grecian Empire ruled with the same power or authority as Alexander the Great. And that is true. None of the four divisions or four king generals who subdivided Alexander's empire ever had the same power or authority that Alexander the Great had enjoyed. Now, this brings us to verses 9 through 14, the next part of Daniel's vision, and 9 through 14 goes together with verses 23 through 25. 23 through 25 being the interpretation of 9 through 14. As Daniel goes on to observe his vision, he says, verse 9, and out of one of them, out of one of the four horns, in other words, out of one of the four sub-Grecian kingdoms, came forth a rather small horn. Here's another little horn. This is a fifth horn. There have been four came up out of the head of the male goat. But then out of one of those four horns, there is a fifth horn, a little horn that arises with this male goat. And he says to this small horn, verse 9, it grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land. And it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, from the commander of the host, and the place of the commander's sanctuary was thrown down. And on account of transgression, the host will be given over to the horn, along with the regular sacrifice. And it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the vision about the regular sacrifice apply, while the transgression causes horror, so as to allow both the holy place and the host to be trampled? And he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. In his vision, Daniel sees a fifth horn for this male goat, a fifth horn that arises out of one of the original four horns. And this fifth horn, this little horn, is very unique indeed. He magnifies himself against the commander of the hosts of heaven. That's against God. He removes the regular sacrifices being offered to God. And he desecrates the holy sanctuary of God. Now, who is this character represented by this little horn, this fifth horn of the Grecian kingdom? Well, look, if you would, at verse 23, where Gabriel begins to interpret this little horn. Gabriel says, and in the latter period of their rule, in the latter period of the rule of these four Grecian sub-kingdoms, when the transgressors have run their course, a king will arise, insolent and skilled in intrigue, and his power will be mighty, not by his own power. And he will destroy to an extraordinary degree and will prosper and perform his will. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. And through his shrewdness, he will cause deceit to succeed by his influence. And he will magnify himself in his heart, and he will destroy many while they are at ease. He will even oppose the prince of princes. But he will be broken without human agency. Gabriel tells Daniel that this little horn, this fifth horn of the Grecian kingdoms, represents a king that would come to power over one of the four subdivision kingdoms of Alexander the great Grecian Gentile world empire. The question is, when would this king come to power? Well, verse 23 gives us some clues concerning when this Grecian king would come to power. For one thing, we are told it would be when this kingdom, this Grecian kingdom, would be toward its end. Now, it is a fact of history that one of the four Grecian kingdoms came to its end around 100 BC. It was that particular Grecian kingdom that ruled the lands of Babylon and Syria around the 300s, 200s, and 100s BC. That particular Grecian kingdom ended around 100 BC. The greatest king, the most powerful king of that one particular Grecian kingdom was a man who had two titles. Sometimes he was called Antiochus IV. But he was more popularly known as Antiochus Epiphanes. A-N-T-I-O-C-H-U-S. And then E-P-I-P-H-A-N-E-S, Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus IV. Antiochus Epiphanes reigned over this particular division of the Grecian Empire from the years 175 to 163 B.C. Notice that is in the last century of that particular Grecian kingdom's rule and influence in the Middle East. 175 to 163 B.C. Antiochus Epiphanes is the little horn of Daniel's vision in chapter 8. But there's a second clue as to when he would come into power and reign. We're also told in verse 23 that he would come into power when the transgressors have run their course. When the transgressors have run their course. During the 100 B.C., when Antiochus Epiphanes was ruling, many Jews decided to reject their worship of Jehovah, the true and the living God, and to go apostate. In other words, to fall away from Jehovah. And there were a great many Jews, again, during the 100 B.C., who started worshiping pagan Greek gods in place of the true and the living God. After all, Greece was in control of them at this time, and this was a group of Jews that wanted to be fully accepted by their Grecian rulers. And they decided, we're going to throw over all of our Jewish heritage, background, and worship. We reject the true worship of the true God, and we adopt the worship of the Greek pagan gods. Those are the transgressors to whom the angel Gabriel refers here in verse 23, and he's saying Antiochus Epiphanes will come to power when these transgressors are functioning there among the people of Israel. In verses 9 through 14 and verses 23 through 25, Gabriel spells out several characteristics of this little horn, or of Antiochus Epiphanes. Let me deal with these particular characteristics of Antiochus Epiphanes. According to verse 23, we are told that this king would be of fierce countenance, is the way the King James translation has it. The New American Standard Bible says he will be insolent. And the word that is used there indicates that this man would be hard, unyielding, determined. And indeed, Antiochus Epiphanes was. He was absolutely determined that he would stamp out totally the worship of Jehovah among all the Jewish people. He wasn't satisfied that just some of the Jews rejected the worship of Jehovah. He was determined that all the Jews would reject the worship of Jehovah and adopt the worship of the Greek gods. And he became very hard and unyielding in this policy against the people of Israel at this particular time. But a second characteristic we're told about him, again, the end of verse 23, is that he would be skilled in intrigue. This means that this man would use great deceit and craft to cover up his true purposes. And Antiochus Epiphanes did. He used great deceit with the Jewish people to try to trick them into following his policies. A very crafty, deceitful man, skilled in deceit or intrigue in his dealing with people in order to get his way. Third characteristic concerning him is given in verse 24. His power will be mighty. The implication being that he would become a very powerful man, but notice, verse 24, not by his own power. He would be a very powerful man, but not exerting just human power, his own power. The implication being this man would have supernatural influence and empowerment from Satan. Satan was determined to annihilate the people of Israel from the face of the earth so that the Redeemer could not be born into the world through the nation of Israel. And here he had a Gentile ruler who was anti-Semitic in his outlook, a hatred of Jews, and he decided to give this Gentile ruler supernatural powers to use against the Jews to annihilate them from the face of the earth so that the promised Redeemer could not come through that nation. The fourth characteristic that is given concerning him, verse 24, is he will destroy to an extraordinary degree. And look at the end of verse 24. He will destroy mighty men and the holy people. It is a fact of history that when Antiochus Epiphanes commanded all the Jews to stop their worship of Jehovah and to worship the Greek pagan gods, many of the Jews absolutely refused to fall away from the true and the living God and refused to obey Antiochus Epiphanes' command. And the end result is that Antiochus Epiphanes began systematically killing Israeli people. He commanded that any parents who would have a male infant circumcised in obedience to Jehovah's command, those parents were to be put to death. Any Jews who would offer a sacrifice to Jehovah were to be put to death. He desecrated the temple of God in Jerusalem. He had a female pig carried in to the altar of sacrifice and put on that altar by some of his Greek Syrian soldiers, and they offered up a female pig as a sacrifice to the head Greek god Zeus in the very temple of the god who had forbidden Jews to have anything to do with pigs. This was his way of defiling the sanctuary of the true and the living God. And he had an image of the chief god Zeus erected in the temple of God in the city of Jerusalem. And he began to destroy the Jewish people who refused to go along with these policies of stamping out the worship of the true and the living God. The fifth characteristic that we are told of him, verse 25, is that he will prosper and perform his will. For a period of years, Antiochus Epiphanes did prosper, and he did carry out what he wanted to carry out. Very strong-willed man and ruler. The sixth characteristic of this man is contained in verse 9. We are told that he would become great toward the south, the east, and the glorious land, and that was true. Antiochus Epiphanes conquered parts of Egypt to the south. He conquered parts of ancient Armenia to the east of where he was ruling. And he conquered the land of Israel. That is what verse 9 calls the glorious land, and brought the Jewish people under his domination. The seventh characteristic of Antiochus Epiphanes is given in verses 11 and 25. we are told that he would magnify himself to the point of defying God. And indeed, we've already seen that he did that by desecrating the temple of God and putting the image of a pagan Greek god into God's temple and forbidding the worship of the true and the living God and ordering the Jewish people instead to worship Zeus and the other Greek gods. Through those means, he did indeed magnify himself to the point of defying God. He stopped all of the Jewish sacrifices to Jehovah, the true and the living God, and desecrated God's temple. The eighth characteristic of this man is given in verse 12. We are told that he would cast truth to the ground. And indeed he did. He tried to stamp out and abolish the truth of God that the Jewish people had. The ninth characteristic, verse 25, we are told that in security, he would destroy many. Antiochus Epiphanes was a fiendish man. Because many of the Orthodox Jews would refuse to adopt his policy, he knew that being Orthodox, they would never defend themselves or wage war on the Sabbath day. And so many times he purposely waited until the Sabbath day to launch his attacks upon the Jews, to massacre them, because he knew that they would not defend themselves, nor would they fight back on the Sabbath day. So in security, he destroyed many. He knew that he would be secure in striking out against them on their Sabbath days. And so on their Sabbath days, he destroyed many of the people of Israel. Now a question could be asked here, how long was this man going to get away with this kind of treatment of God's Old Testament people? The answer is given to us in verses 13 and 14. We are told that he would be able to do this for 2,300 days. 2,300 days. That's a little over 6 years that he would be able to hold sway against the people of Israel before God finally brought him to his end. Here's a fact of history, and please keep in mind, God is foretelling this before it ever happens. It is a fact of history that Antiochus Epiphanes began to persecute the people of Israel in 171 B.C. His persecution of the Jews ended in 165 B.C. You subtract 165 from 171, and that comes out to 6 years. He would hold sway for a little over 6 years against the Jews, and that's exactly what he did from 171 to 165. There was a priestly family of Jews called the Maccabees. And one day Antiochus Epiphanes sent some of the soldiers down to a place outside Jerusalem where one of the Maccabean priests was offering sacrifices to God down there. Since they couldn't offer them to God in the temple, they started to offer them outside Jerusalem. And Antiochus sent some of his troops down there to end those sacrifices to Jehovah and ordered his troops to desecrate that altar also with a horrible type of sacrifice to Zeus. And when the soldiers walked up to that altar, Judas Maccabeus pulled a knife from out from underneath his robe and murdered the pagan Gentile soldier that was about doing that. And that started a revolt on the part of Jews against this man and his Gentile army. And pretty soon, faithful Jewish men from all over the countryside joined themselves to the Maccabeans and were trained in guerrilla warfare, and they began to fight against Antiochus Epiphanes and his Greek soldiers, and by the grace of God, they are able to drive out this ruthless man and their Greek oppressors and experience freedom for a period of years. If you have Jewish friends, you know that every December, around Christmas season, they celebrate the Feast of Lights, or Hanukkah. Hanukkah was started originally in the celebration of the Jews, when God finally enabled them to get rid of Antiochus Epiphanes and this Greek-Syrian oppressor that was trying to stamp out the truth and worship of Jehovah, the true and the living God. The end of verse 14, we're told that at the end of those 2300 days, the holy place would be properly restored. After the Jews drived out Antiochus Epiphanes, they did indeed go back to the temple in Jerusalem, and they cleansed it and restored the worship of Jehovah there again. What happened to Antiochus? Verse 25, Gabriel says, the end of that verse, he will be broken without human agency. It is a fact of history that several years after Antiochus was forced to withdraw his rule from Israel, he died of madness, insanity, while on another military expedition. No human being put him to death. He died of insanity. Just as God said, he will be broken without human agency. Tremendous prophecy of what God was going to do in the near future with the people of Israel. He would chasten them because they had rebelled in the past against him in many respects. And he would use Medo-Persia, he would use Greece as his chastening rods against the people of Israel. Lord willing, in our next session, when we come to Daniel chapter 9, we're going to see Daniel in essence saying, Lord, but what about the far future in your dealings with the people of Israel? And in Daniel chapter 9, God reveals the whole distant future of his program and his dealings with the nation of Israel. God our Father, we thank you again that through a prophecy such as this, you have displayed so vividly the fact that you are indeed the sovereign God in control of the flow of history. You revealed this part of ancient history years before it was fulfilled. Some of it, Lord, you revealed almost 400 years before it actually transpired. Only a sovereign God can do that and then cause it to happen exactly as you said it would. So we who are your people today, through faith in Jesus Christ, bow before you once again and adore you and worship you as the only true and sovereign God. In Jesus' name, we offer up this worship. Amen.
A free catalog listing other titles in our cassette library will be sent to you upon request. Simply address your request to the Friends of Israel, Post Office Box 123, West Collingswood, New Jersey, 08107.